This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
My name is Heath Brown, and I'm really interested in how and why people get along and create great scholarship together. This is the co-authored podcast where we look behind the curtain and learn how scholars of politics collaborate, one project at a time.
Ready to talk about collaboration in the academic world. Because I think it's very natural. I think that the academic enterprise can be very isolating, very lonely, not only because you do your reading and your writing and your research, you can do it alone, but also because I think the academic enterprise generates a certain amount of competition and nastiness, which isolates people one from the other. And who wants to spend all their time alone?
That question seemed so simple when we first recorded this in January 2020. It seems less so now. But Fran Piven is right. Who does want to spend all their time alone? Especially when one of the most fruitful academic partnerships is also a love story.
Richard and I were lovers, and we've been talking about this as though we were just two people who had similar interests. But our love life very much affected our work life.
This podcast is about the four-decade collaboration between Francis Fox Piven and Richard Cloward. Cloward died in 2001, but Fran Piven, now retired from the City University of New York, is still writing and sharing her insights. But we're jumping ahead a little bit. Before there was Piven and Cloward, the books, Poor People's Movements and Regulating the Poor, before Francis Fox Piven and Richard Cloward were lovers, they had to meet. And for them to eventually meet, Fran Piven first had to move to Chicago to start college at only 14 years old.
My brother came back from the Air Force in World War II, and he was doing graduate work at the University of Chicago, and he had the idea of helping me to apply for the Hutchins program, where they actually allowed high school sophomores to apply, and I did. I applied when I was 14 or 15.
As a parent today, this seems like a bad idea to me. But maybe this worked better then. Here's how she describes it.
The University of Chicago, under Robert Hutchins' guidance, was completely inappropriate for a 15-year-old. Mm-hmm. Completely inappropriate. For one thing, you didn't have to go to class. And so if you're 15 years old, you didn't go to class. You had to show up once a year for the exams. That was all you had to do.
Fran Piven took some multiple choice exams and somehow passed, and passed well enough to return to New York and look for work. She also started a doctoral program and began to focus on urban planning.
So I remember coming up here to the Columbia campus and meeting with Sayre and Neustadt and Truman, David Truman. He was the third person who had this big foreign money. And I got a fellowship with them, and I did a study of the functions of research in city planning decisions. And that's how I got my PhD. Herman Stein, who was at the Columbia School of Social Work, I knew him slightly through my husband, who was a student at the School of Social Work, and he wanted me to do a project for him, to do a paper on urban renewal research or something like that. And I was looking for a job at that point. So I did it. And through him, I met Richard Cloward and George Brager. And they invited me to work on the proposal they were doing for Mobilization for Youth. So I did the housing section of that proposal.
I know what you're thinking. This sounds like a bad idea. Don't mix work and pleasure. Someone is going to get left out, especially from the credit they deserve. But Piven and Cloward had a plan. They knew too many women had been left out, their names forgotten and contributions erased. So she figured out what to do.
I announced a rule, because Richard was much better known than I was in his, you know, circle. And I thought I could really get ruined by collaborating with him, because he would take all the credit. He would get all the credit and he would take it, because he was a guy, you know, and a vain guy like most guys. So I proposed a rule that, and this is why my name is first on so much stuff. If I did most of the writing, my name was first. If he did most of the writing, his name was first. We would talk about it. We would rough outline for the chapter, and we would divvy it up. And we had some conflict over credit, and it wasn't deadly.
Not only was it not deadly, it produced some major work that pushed social scientists to rethink poverty, welfare policy, and social movements, including an article in The Nation that explained their findings.
I think about 1963, Mobilization for Youth came under attack by the deputy mayors, Paul Scrivain and the Daily News and the New York City Police Department. There were a series of headlines in the Daily News to the effect that Mobilization for Youth had hired communists, things like that. So what Mobilization tried to do was develop a defense of their programs on the ground by describing what they did, who they saw, how many they saw, and they recruited me to help them with that. One of the programs they had, remember this was a collaboration, right? Settlement houses on the Lower East Side, Columbia School of Social Work, and IMH. One of the programs was a neighborhood service center, it was called. And basically, it was developed because the programs that were dear to the hearts of the principals didn't really make enough provision for social workers. And there had to be a place for social workers. So they decided they would have a neighborhood service center program. They would rent storefronts and put social workers in the storefronts to respond to the walk-ins, people with problems or without shoes when school was starting, that kind of thing. But basically, nobody actually knew what the storefronts would do. But we wanted to defend all the programs. So we got assigned a defense of the neighborhood service center. So we had to figure out what they were doing. So we gave them little cards. You can see how important cards mm-hmm. are to my intellectual life. So, and the little cards asked the social workers who were sitting in the storefronts, using sort of social worker language, what was the presented problem? What was the actual problem? What did you do? But the thing was that it really looked as though a minority of the people who were eligible for welfare were on welfare. It looked like 2-1 or something like that. Well, that was very interesting because we had been spending a lot of time with poor people in the course of our different endeavors. And we knew that there were fledgling groups of poor women, for example, who, you know, they were in the spirit of the times. They were getting together and yelling and making demands and things like that. And we had an idea for how to sort of craft and channel those demands that we in ways that we thought would have big public policy consequences. And that's what that article was.
And they didn't stop there and finish their writing with just the article in The Nation. They started to talk about these findings, talking about the findings with the people in the movements representing poor people and the disenfranchised. Here's Richard Cloward in 1968 explaining the research findings to civil rights leader George Wiley at a convening on poverty reduction.
How much would you say is denied by these illegal practices?
The research that we've done would suggest that the American public welfare system is only expending half of what it should be expending if it were reaching all of the people who are eligible under existing statutes. So we think welfare costs should probably double. Just on minimum standards, just on household furnishings and heavy clothing in New York City, they're being cheated out of $50 million this year, just in that one city.
This research ended up in the first big book from this collaboration, Regulating the Poor. And this argument that there were incredible underutilizations of welfare and harmful paternalism in the system was a new one, and one that caused a stir. Piven and Cloward were roundly criticized in social work circles. This work caused people to rethink whether the promise of a social safety net was anything other than a promise. And it was this research and the article in The Nation that for many had been forgotten that has caused another stir 40 years later. That was when Glenn Beck seized on it, repeatedly attacking Piven and Cloward in the mid-2000s for their role in a mass conspiracy.
Let me introduce you to the people who you would say are fundamentally responsible for the unsustainability and possible collapse of our economic system. There are really two people I've been telling you for a while. There they are. Cloward and Piven. Richard Cloward, Francis Fox Piven. They are authors of the Cloward-Piven strategy. Something else to remember is that this isn't some conspiracy theory that we're tossing out here. They wrote about collapsing the economy and how they plan to do it in an article they co-authored in the 1960s, Mobilizing the Poor, How It Could Be Done. 6 months later, published in The Nation under the title The Weight of the Poor, A Strategy to End Poverty.
Here's Phil Rocco, now a professor at Marquette University, talking about his experience while a graduate student at UC Berkeley.
I was probably around the carols at IGS, Institute of Governmental Studies at Berkeley, and people were like, oh my God, Glenn Beck is talking about, you know, Fran Piven or something. And it was sort of, there was a little bit of, I think just this sense of, okay, political science matters, at least it matters enough to piss off, you know, this person who was at the time, I think, one of the more exceptionally radical right commentators.
And this is Mark Schmidt from New America, who wrote about the Glenn Beck feud with Piven and Cloward and others.
Yeah, well, I think it was around that time that Glenn Beck became particularly prominent. And I was really fascinated by the way in which he'd kind of created this history of the left and was telling a story about how all these influences fed into, you know, what they saw as this radical Obama counter-revolution, I guess. And what was interesting to me is I felt like so much of that history was actually not only obviously not really feeding Obama, which was a pretty centrist administration, certainly in retrospect, but a lot of it wasn't super familiar even to young people on the left as they were becoming activists. And I mentioned people like Joel Rogers at the University of Wisconsin, you know, important figure, but turned into, I think Glenn Beck called him the mastermind or something like that, of everything. And he had a lot, you know, he had some influence and Piven and Cloward, they particularly picked up, Beck particularly picked up on Piven and Cloward's like a 1968 Nation article where they argued that poor people should really just push the system and get everybody on the rolls. And that would actually force the political system to kind of adjust and create something maybe closer to a guaranteed income.
Decades after this article in The Nation came out, decades after the book had been published, Glenn Beck had discovered Piven and Cloward. And what followed was a continual, relentless focus on these two scholars, linking some strange version of their ideas to the most elaborate conspiracies to take down the country. Piven and Cloward had already been famous in the circles of academic conferences, social movement organizing, in political science, sociology, and social work. The reintroduction to the popular conversation from someone like Glenn Beck was an unusual part of this family love story.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
This is the second part of the co-authored podcast episode on Piven and Cloward. Earlier, we heard about how these two met and about the early research on poverty and social welfare in New York City. We pick up there far from the Lower East Side, now in Wisconsin.
So I was at Mickey's Tavern on Willie Street, as it's known. It was a bar in Madison, and I was sitting at the bar and went up to use the bathroom, and in the bathroom above the urinal, there was some graffiti that said Piven Cloward Strategy.
That was Phil Rocco. Piven and Cloward, these two collaborators, had made a mark with their research on social welfare policies in the 1960s. They didn't stop there, but continuing was going to be difficult.
We considered breaking up. Now, you got to understand, Richard was married and had four children. And this affair was not simple. And four children is never simple. So we did break up. And when we broke up, there was the question of, what about the work that we've already done that became poor people's movements? And we never resolved that.
Resolving this break in the work relationship ultimately took resolving the personal relationship.
I moved from New York and I moved from Columbia School of Social Work. I took a job at Boston University. I moved with my daughter to an apartment in Brookline. I was finished. What led to the resolution is that Richard started coming up to Boston to win me back.
Back together, they completed the second big book, Poor People's Movements. And this one made an even bigger splash. Interest in Piven and Cloward, but especially Fran Piven, rose because their research ran headlong into the ascendant conservative intellectual movement and the increasingly popular public faces of conservative intellectuals with a national audience for their ideas.
As an undergraduate, I'd worked in the economics department as a clerk secretary. I typed letters for Milton Friedman, and he called me. He didn't have somebody else call me. He called me and asked me to come to Chicago for the debate. When I got to Chicago, to Harper Library, there was a producer there, because this wasn't just something Milton Friedman was doing out of his back pocket. This was a well-funded operation. So I met with the producer, and he said, "We have one rule." "What's that?" "No mention of Chile."
Your conception of freedom, does that apply in Chile today?
Where Chile is not politically free. Chile today does not have political freedom. And I do not condone, but let me go on for a moment, if you will. You raise the question, let me answer it. Chile is not a politically free system, and I do not condone the political system. But the people there are freer.
Now, if you listen to that debate, you can see that I did not obey the rule. I thought to myself, you can't enforce that rule because I don't want to come back.
This says so much about Piven and Cloward. This research collaboration was never just about an academic audience. The audience was always much wider, whether it was readers of The Nation magazine, social movement organizers, or television viewers eager to hear Milton Friedman win a debate. Their collaboration was ready to fight for the research in an academic conference session, community center, or TV studio. Here is Dara Strolovich, a professor at Princeton University.
I think I've often found myself just reminding myself, but also my students and my colleagues, of the fact of her existence and of her scholarship's existence as a pretty, I think, important counter to the assertion that bringing our normative and political questions and commitments or priors or whatever we want to call them with us to our research is, first of all, that that's only something progressives do. But more important, that that's a problem. I think part of what her work makes clear is that some of the best research is actually grounded in those normative and political questions and commitments, in commitments to trying to use research to figure out how to make, you know, what's wrong with the world and how to make it a better place.
There is so much more to this research collaboration than the writing and speaking. The agenda was bigger than that. These also were two people, ultimately husband and wife, who had a very different way to view their work and their lives.
I think we both thought of it as that the personal relationship enhanced the collaboration. We both thought that. And maybe it wasn't true, but that's what we thought. We never shut the door on the work. We always talked about the work, 24/7, really.
With two books down, Piven and Cloward continued their research, and the world was changing. The politics of the 1960s had ended, yet the core issues of political representation, participation, and poverty hadn't. Piven and Cloward shifted their focus to voting.
That was a big project, why Americans still don't vote, because I guess this was true in welfare rights too. What we did, we didn't just write the book. We raised money and established an NGO to recruit social agencies to do voter registration. We thought that the 60s movements were over and that what we could do now is we could try to promote full electoral participation. That's what we tried to do. And we did have an impact. The National Voter Registration Act was the result of a network of advocate organizations. They lobbied for what was called agency-based registration. All that meant is that if you had contact with a social agency, they would offer to register you to vote. That's all it meant.
But by the 1990s and 2000s, the country and its politics had changed so much. The movements and protests that the earlier collaboration fit into were largely gone. Here's Mark Schmidt again, talking about his experience in Washington, D.C. at that time. He worked in the Senate during the welfare reform debate, and he describes what he saw.
When Senator Moynihan, who's played a complicated role in all this, you know, when you're on the Senate floor, you can kind of look out through a door, and then there's a door beyond it, and you can really see all the way to the Washington Monument. And Moynihan says, you know, there ought to be people, like masses of people, you know, visible out that door protesting what we're doing here today. And there was nobody. We almost never, even those of us on the, you know, the right side of the debate, and I very much think we were on the right side of that debate, we didn't have a, you know, you'd have an occasional meeting with like a group from Acorn, and there would be 15 people from, you know, in my case, maybe from Jersey City or Newark, but there was nothing like, you know, there was nothing like a poor people's movement in that debate. And that was always striking to me because, you know, the books reminded me that there once had been, and where we are now, it feels like there can be again. But this was a really big gap where there was neither a theory nor a movement, and we were working with what we had, but it was pretty limited.
The country had changed, but the academy also did as well. And later generations of scholars have revisited Piven and Cloward, updated the findings, and expanded the theoretical arguments. Here's Phil Rocco again.
Recall that it was around this time that many of the papers that went into the book by Richard Fording, Joe Soss, and Sanford Schramm. And it was around that time that book came out, which, of course, the title itself is a play on regulating the poor by Piven and Cloward. And I think that book, in many ways, reconfigured and kind of recalibrated some of the analysis in regulating the poor. And at the very least, thinking about social policy as a tool of punishments, of discipline, of enforcing certain kinds of order. And I think the idea of like neoliberal paternalism that book sort of introduces is a you know, an interesting sort of update in certain ways to regulating the poor. At least that's how I read it.
And here's Dara Strolovich again.
It feels a little bit like asking someone when the first time they encountered the Cat in the Hat was or something like that. It sort of feels like it's always been in my head that it's been so completely constitutive of how I think about and what I know about power and politics and policy. Poor People's Movements has really been the text I go back to over and over. I teach it to both undergraduates and graduate students. And as I've said, their sort of taking on of pluralist assumptions has been super important and featured really centrally in my thinking, even in at moments when I kind of was trying to do the opposite of what they were suggesting. Within American politics, and I've written about this and I certainly teach about this, the dominance of pluralism and the pluralist way of thinking about protest really kind of cordoned off social movements from the study of American politics. It's part of why, and again, this is a little more autobiographical about me than it is about them, but it's part of why I ended up studying organized interests, advocacy groups, interest groups, whatever you want to call them, was because the subfield, there was so little room for the study of protest. And part of why, and so even though I did that in my own work and for a range of reasons, I think that part of why their work, especially Poor People's Movements, was so important to me was because they actually took on those pluralist assumptions that were so constraining. And Piven and Cloward insisted that that was misguided and that was wrong. They pushed back against pluralist assumptions that politics is about equal groups competing for resources. They pushed back against pluralist assumptions that defined unrest as deviant and not political, but in fact apolitical. They pushed back against, as I started to say earlier, that the way for disadvantaged, marginalized groups to get a foothold was through mass-based permanent organizations, and insisted that disruption was not, as the pluralists were insisting, had been insisting and had sort of so structured the way we it was the dominant understandings in the study of American politics, that disruption was not pathological. Disruption was not a sign of anti-social, anti-political behavior, but was rather the, you know, to borrow Jim Scott's terminology, the weapon of the weak. It's not exactly what he's talking about, but and that we needed to take it seriously as political, as politics.
Piven and Cloward fought for this dimension of politics to be taken as seriously as parties, elections, and voting. The legacy of this collaboration is in part these updates and extensions to their work, but also what to make of Piven and Cloward together, working endless hours in New York and Boston, rarely taking a break. This was the approach to the collaboration, not one I've ever tried, but one that worked for them.
We both of us knew that the collaboration in the work enhanced our personal relationship and vice versa. We didn't think of them as straining against each other.
This episode of the Co-Authored Podcast has been produced by Sam Anderson, supported by the American Political Science Association, John Jay College, and the New Books Network. Thank you for listening.